that push, that have opposed Medicaid expansion, that push deregulation and tax cuts at the state level, that have pushed voting restrictions. And, you know, now he's giving money to Leonard Leo, who is, you know, we understand Side considers himself to be a libertarian, but, you know, Leonard Leo is a staunch social conservative who has, you know, built the Supreme Court to tear down abortion rights in this country. So, you know, we see that he's funding a very, very radical right-wing program.
And education?
Well, so he's funded a lot of, we believe, some universities. He appears to be the donor who gave $20 million to rename George Mason University's law school after Antonin Scalia. You know, we see that he was frequently emailing with professors there, with one he was particularly friendly with, as well as the dean. And, you know, you could see that they were quite eager to please him. He's also been, we believe, a donor to Hillsdale College, which, you know, has come up in recent years, and that it's helped undermine the idea or undermine the science related to COVID. And it's also served as sort of a feeder for the Trump administration for jobs there.
Why these two universities and colleges in particular, Hillsdale College and George Mason University?
Yeah, well, so with Hillsdale, we understand that that Barry is quite interested in the great books curriculum, you know, these kind of Western classics. With George Mason, it's a university that is politically influential. It's right outside the nation's capital, and it's become, you know, this sort of Supreme Court university. It's the law school is named after Antonin Scalia, and then we see that judges Clarence Thomas, Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch have taught there in recent years as well.
We want to thank you, Andrew Perez, for being with us, senior editor and reporter at The Lever. We'll link to your new expose with ProPublica, How a Billionaire's Attack Philanthropy Secretly Funded Climate Denialism and Right-Wing Causes. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a People and Culture Manager. If you are or know someone who's interested in HR, please go to democracynow.org and apply at that website, or send it around to others you know. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Taracena, Trina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Portland's favorite talk radio at 8 on Fridays returns at 8 on Friday, September 16th. Tammy and Althea are back to bring you thoughtful insights, colorful commentary, activist interviews, and community conversation. Minding it, bridging it, filling it in. The Gap returns to KBOO on Friday, September 16th at 8 a.m.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam, and you're listening to KBOO.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we continue our six-part series, Conversations in Southern Illinois. It is part of an occasional Sojourner Truth series on bridging the rural-urban divide in the United States. Today, as part two of our Conversations in Southern Illinois series, you will hear from Clint Heisey. He has lived in Southern Illinois for 46 years. He has worked as a logger, ran a mechanic shop, worked as a coal power plant worker, and has also been a caregiver. He has also spent time as a single dad. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics.
Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. The United Nations nuclear watchdog is calling for a security zone around Europe's largest nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia, Ukraine. After a UN inspection at the plant last week, it's been under heavy shelling since Russia invaded Ukraine. Christopher Martinez has more.
Increasing attacks on Ukraine's largest nuclear power plant have led to fears of a potential nuclear disaster as Ukraine and Russia trade blame. Rafael Grossi is director general of the IAEA.
My urge, my appeal, is to work together, on the protection of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant through the establishment of a nuclear safety and security protection zone.
Grossi says the safety protection zone is not demilitarization, though he says it could be a step towards that. Grossi describes it as a bubble around the plant. Recommendation is part of a 52-page report the IAEA released Tuesday following its visit to the site. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Council he remains gravely concerned about the situation around the plant, including reports of recent shelling.
Any damage, whether intentional or not, to Europe's largest nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia or to any other nuclear facility in Ukraine could spell catastrophe. All steps must be taken to avoid such a scenario. Common sense and cooperation must guide the way forward.
The IAEA's report was careful not to blame either side for the attacks on the nuclear power plant. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Meanwhile, a Ukrainian official says Russia has resumed shelling in the area of the Zaporizhia power plant. A Ukrainian regional governor said a city on the opposite bank of the Dnieper River was fired on with rockets and heavy artillery today. The Washington Post reports amongst the documents seized at Donald Trump's estate when FBI agents raided Mar-a-Lago last month was a document describing a foreign government's military defenses, including its nuclear capabilities. The reporting does not specify which nation. The document was so sensitive, most couldn't even view it, according to the report. But it was found in a box in Mar-a-Lago with little known security. Nuclear nonproliferation groups point to the further dangers of atomic weapons. A new report says the names of hundreds of U.S. law enforcement officers, elected officials, and military members appear on the leaked membership rolls of a far-right extremist group that's been accused of playing a key role in the deadly January 6th Capitol siege. The Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism pored over more than 38,000 names on leaked Oath Keeper membership lists to find more than 370 people it believes are currently working in law enforcement agencies. It also identified more than 80 people who were running for or served in public office as of early August. The membership information was compiled into a database published by the Transparency Collective Distributed Denial of Secrets. Several people told the Associated Press they were briefly members years ago and are no longer affiliated with the group, some finding its views too extreme. Several of its members, including its founder, are on trial related to their role in the deadly January 6th attack. The data shows the most members are in California and Texas, California having more than 3,000 members, including 4 elected officials, 24 law enforcement officers, 12 military members, and 9 first responders. Texas has more than 3,300 members, including 8 elected officials, 33 law enforcement officers, 10 military members, and 7 first responders. The UK's new Prime Minister, Liz Truss, has ruled out a windfall tax on oil companies to pay for her plans to tackle Britain's energy crisis. Truss underscored her opposition to the tax during her first session of Prime Minister's Questions in the House of Commons today and went toe-to-toe with the Labour Party's leader, Keir Starmer.
The Treasury estimates are that the energy producers will make £170 billion in excess profits over the next 2 years. She knows that every single pound in excess profits she chooses not to tax is an extra pound on borrowing that working people will be forced to pay back for decades to come. More borrowing than is needed. That's the true cost of her choice to protect oil and gas profits, isn't it?
Mr. Speaker, the reality is that this country will not be able to tax its way to growth.
Earlier, Truss met with her cabinet for the first time. She's appointed a government diverse in race and gender. For the first time, none of the UK's great offices of state, Prime Minister, Chancellor, Foreign Secretary, and Home Secretary, is held by a white man. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Now we will hear from our Conversations in Southern Illinois series, today featuring Clint Heisey, a longtime resident of rural Southern Illinois.
In the group discussion, you talked about the sludge that was brought in from Chicago, was it?
Right.
To this area. Yeah. Just say a bit about that. What was it? What happened?
Well, it was a venture. The Forestry Service had taken the contract to reclaim strip mine land. Since mining is one of the bigger incomes that people have been able to do down here.
What kind of mining?
Traditionally, it was strip mine, where they take the top soil off, maybe the top 40 to 50 feet of soil, and mine a vein of coal. But that leaves a lot of debris, mountains of clinkers, and of course, all the topsoil they remove after they're done. After the vein is finished mining, it's usually just left. Back in the 70s, they began to reclaim that. There was some grant money for the Forestry Service to do a trial. Chicago at that time was running out of space for their sewage. So they were going back to very old sewage lagoons, 40, anywhere from 30, 40, 50 years old. And they liquefied the sludge. It was dried there, my understanding is. They would liquefy it, pump it on into tank cars, and ship a whole train load down here to Southern Illinois. That's 350 miles. My job
at that. What was in that sludge?
Well, that's questionable. When they were. Back then, they didn't differentiate between household septic, industrial waste.
Oh my God!
Combination of everything was put in these lagoons. That was another reason they wanted to get rid of it. I wish I knew some of the specifics on what part of Chicago this was pumped from, but I don't. My job on this end, when the trains came down, was to operate the pumps. The sewage was dumped, gravity fed into lagoons here as the trains came through. And from that point, it was pumped in out to the fields, the old coal mine land. And tractors disked it into the ground, did some leveling of the ground at that point.
What was the purpose of this, though? Why were they taking the sludge out to the fields?
Well, the ground is basically dead after the mining.
The mining.
After the mining, it's hard to describe. We need to go out there and look.
It kills the soil.
It kills the soil, yeah. You've turned it all over, and there's all kinds of rocks and debris and clinkers left from the mining action. Other than that, it just looks like a moonscape. Eventually, some, weeds will always grow in anything. So eventually there's some growth there, but nothing productive will ever grow there. So what the sludge did have was this high nitrogen. along with heavy metals and pesticides and chemicals. But it is high nitrogen, and it was free. And Chicago wanted to get rid of it, and we were a good dumping ground.
Southern Illinois.
So they would pump it out on the fields, dist it in, big tractors, you know, just like a farming operation. And they planted an assortment of grasses and crops in that reclaimed land. Over the years, then they tested the crops and grasses for which ones would take up the pesticides, is what they were looking at, the chemicals and the heavy metals.
What do you mean by take it up?
Well, some plants will extract that from the soil, and it's in the plant itself then, you know.
I see.
So those would be...
So the plants help to clean the soil then, in a way?
Well, it's still there. They're all the chemicals and heavy metals are still there. They're just some of them are removed, and they're in the plant matter instead of being in the ground. The key there is, can you feed it? Which ones can they then in turn feed to animals? Some grasses didn't seem to extract the heavy metals and chemicals like others did. My understanding, I wasn't in that phase of it. That came years later after my part of it.
What was your part? Tell us about it.
I operated the there's huge sludge pumps that would pump it out of these lagoons out into the fields. So I was just on the mechanical side. That was just one part of it. Everybody had a job there for me.
Was that strenuous, that kind of work?
No, it was just it was evenings, night, late night, in the day, because once the day started, then the tractors would start their plowing and disking.
So this was a night job?
Right.
It was what
a night
hours?
Job. I would go in about 8 o'clock at night, finish up, you know, somewhere 8 hours later, depending on what was necessary, you know, how long the train was, how long it took to dump, whether they had any malfunction, you know, that would have to be fixed. You know, it was a gravity feed out of the train, so valve stuck, you know, that would be the most common malfunction. Doors, you know, it was cold, doors would freeze. I hadn't thought about that in a long time, you know. My phase was just that part, and then I went on to another job after that.
How long did you do that job?
I was
sludge pumping.
6-7 months. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a short-term job, just a temporary job.
Mm-hmm.
The forestry, interesting that the Forestry Service had the, they were the go-between. They had the contract to do that. Looking back on it, that seems kind of odd.
Yeah.
But now that land is valuable because it's...
Why? You know,
well, it was near the town. It was, you know, visibly it looks nice now. You know, houses are there. I think originally they just thought that would be agriculture, you know, see if they could raise
so
cattle.
So people are living on top of this land that's contaminated.
Yeah. That's why when you raised that question, I had never thought about it again, you know, that could be affecting people.
And the land was a good price. People were able to afford it.
Oh, and back then that land was selling for just the taxes on it. You know, it was worthless, basically. Nobody wanted it. Now people have, like you said, they're making, it's kind of a suburb. People have lakes, they fish. You know, it's... I don't know what it sells for. Another good question to check into, see what it sells for.
What is the name of the area?
It's near the town of Carrier Mills. It's outside of Harrisburg, Illinois. Small town.
Mm, right. So that's one of the jobs you did. You were a younger man then.
Well, I was from the city. You know, I had no mechanical ability or anything else when I moved here. I was pretty green. After that, I had a series
of jobs. What
kinds of
jobs did you do?
One job I had for a while was to log. I was a logger. The land adjacent to me, the man died, and the family that inherited it sold the timber off of it. He needed help, and I needed a job, so I learned how to run a chainsaw then.
And where was this?
This was to the east of my property, just between here and the highway. It's about a 200-acre plot. Had quite a beautiful trees. It was as close to virgin timber as we have down here at that time.
So tell us the name of the area for people who are listening.
That would be Hardin County, Illinois. Closest town we have is Herod, they did have a general store and a post office. Now it's just got a post office. That tells you how big the town is.
Right.
Two or three.
The logging happened in that area.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I worked for him for 7-8 months. Another short term job.
What was he doing with the trees, with the wood?
The trees would be hauled to a lumber yard, sawmills. The initial phase is they would remove the smaller trees, leaving the large trees, the straight ones. He sold those to a veneer company. The large, beautiful white oaks would be turned into veneer for furniture. And those were harvested by a separate company.
Mm-hmm.
They would come in with a specially trained crews to lay down these big trees with the minimal damage. So they were quite valuable back then, and still are.
Yeah.
And, you know, a tall tree that's straight and 2 to 3 foot in diameter, no branches for 20 or 30 feet from the ground, that gives you a lot of veneer.
What size area was locked?
The first plot that I worked on was 200 acres. He did a pretty as least destructive as possible removal. I'll say that for his. And I learned how to drive a log skidder, which is the machine that drags the logs out of the woods. You can mm-hmm. drag, basically you can drag three huge trees with this. It gives you some idea of what kind of a machine it is.
Mm-hmm.
It'd have a winch on the back, cables where you attach it to the tree. So you're going to do some destruction pulling trees out of the woods, but you can minimize that by taking different pathways each time, so you don't leave the same erodible ruts. When you're falling trees, you know, you get better and better at doing that, so you don't damage other trees that will take their place. You know, there's a way to log conservatively and not completely destroy woods. It still does quite a bit of destruction, even at best.
And you did this job for how long again?
I think I was with him for 7 months. I I ended up getting hurt on the job. That was the end of that job.
How did you get hurt? What kind of and what type of injury did you get?
We were logging a plot. It was also another pretty large plot. It was about a quarter mile. It's about 3/8 of a mile across. Several hundred acres again, and it was a rougher area than I had started with him on. It was hilly. It had a lot of we talked about the poisonous snakes down here. It had a lot of copperheads and rattlesnakes there. Rougher ground. In fact, we took the to tell you how we did it. We would take the exhaust off the log skidder and turn it down to the ground so that as we drove over it, the vibration from and noise from the exhaust would tend to run the snakes off. So we wouldn't have to deal with so many of them. One day I was cutting trees on an incline, and I had gotten better at that point. You know, if you never have done that kind of work, you don't. It's pretty dangerous work. I was lucky. I had been lucky quite a few times, but this time I had cut a large tree. I was using a. I don't know if your audience is familiar with steel chainsaws. It was a steel 051 with a 32-inch bar. So I was coming. I had to pretty well come from both sides of this tree to cut it. So that's 60 some odd inches in diameter. That, to give you an idea what kind of tree it was. Yeah. And in this case, it looked like a really good drop because I was on an incline, and you know that helps you. You know where it's going to go. It's not going to fall uphill. You right. think. But as that was falling, something happened so quick I didn't even react to it. I think back now. And the next thing I knew, the tree was across my foot. My left foot was pinned to the ground.
Oh.
I didn't understand how it happened at the time. Later on, obviously I survived and I still have my foot, but
what happened to the foot? What kind of injury did you get?
Well, the problem was it was a while before they came and get the tree off of it. So my first reaction, yeah, this tree was 5 to 10 tons. I don't know what it weighed. Of course,
on your foot.
On my foot. I tried to dig it out, but it turned out there was a rock underneath my foot, and this was falling across it. And I got my chainsaw, was going to cut the butt of the tree, tried to cut it off, but it had been damaged during the accident. It wouldn't run. So my only option...
Others there?
Well,
when this happened?
The way this job was situated is I was cutting on one end of the property, and there was another sawyer, another guy logging on the other side. And my boss would drive the skidder he would drag trees from me for a while. Then he would go over and drag trees that the other guy was cutting. He'd drag it back to the truck.
So you were on your own.
So I was on one side of the property, and I could hear him running their machines on the other end. Like I said, it was about 3/8 of a mile. So I started yelling and praying, and I knew approximately how long it took him for the trip from the other guy to the truck. It took about 5 minutes, you know, the trip. So when he was running that skidder, you know, I knew he wouldn't be able to hear me because the exhaust, like I said, it was like running a car with an open exhaust, only with a huge diesel motor instead of a little gas motor.
So I would wait until he got to the truck. I'd yell. And then when he would take the trip back, he made two trips. So I'm judging 20 minutes. And he was, I knew he was hooking up on the third trip. So I was yelling, and I heard the exhaust, heard him rev up the motor. So I thought, well, there's one more trip he's going to make before I can have a chance for him to hear me. And then I heard the exhaust. I heard him let it off the throttle, and shortly after that, they came running. They had heard me yell over that. I couldn't talk for days after that because I just yelled my voice out. So they came and they finished cutting the butt of the tree out off of my foot. And the only fortunate thing was I was wearing tennis shoes. Had I been wearing steel-toe boots, which OSHA would have required normally, it would have just crushed the metal toe would have been just crushed. But my foot kind of squashed out. It kind of just flattened. It's the way I my understanding is. So it got me to the hospital, and they shot me full of painkillers. And
is anything broken, or was
it? I had some bones removed. It's numb. I don't have a whole lot of feeling in certain parts of that foot, but I still walk on it.
They removed bones.
Yeah, there was some. The toes were crushed. But it's amazing they said if I hadn't been in such good shape, I was a physical kind of a fanatic then. You know, I would saw trees all day and then take a run. It was that fact, I think, in God. He was kind of telling me something. Here's a lesson, boy. You know, here. So that eventually healed. A couple weeks in the hospital, an operation, and then some more recovery.
Your medical costs covered?
It was. Yeah, it was covered by that. And there was at that point. That's when I went back to school and started started my degree. And
why did you make that decision? Did you feel that getting the degree would have more options in terms of the kind of work you were doing? Because the two jobs you described were sort of the sludge, and this one were shorter term jobs, right?
Oh, there was a job in there where I worked on an oil rig. That was another job that I had.
Where was that?
That was near Carmi, which is to the northeast of us. That was
in Illinois.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we actually worked. The rig moved around quite a bit. A drilling might be a 2-week job in one location. You know, move the rig, take a day or two to move the rig, drill another hole. And we did do some drilling in Kentucky also. These were the older style rotary rigs, where maybe a 3,000 foot hole. Compare that to now, when there's 12,000 foot holes are drilled, you know, deep wells. And then you've got the horizontal drilling. It's a whole nother technology than what we were. It was pretty simple.
Was it a small company that you worked for, or a larger?
It was a small company. I think there was probably 3-4 drilling rigs that they owned. It was another learning experience for me. You know, again, you got to remember, I was middle class kid, grew up in the city, had no mechanic training. I had no familiarity with chainsaws or how to fix motors or anything.
Mm-hmm. So in what way did you find it a learning experience?
Well, wish I was dealing with a different type of person down here. I learned to really appreciate the people. A lot of people may have thought they couldn't get along. I was along here. I was a what you call a hippie back then. I had dropped out of college after a year.
Why?
I wanted to travel. I wanted to see the world, get some experience. Traveled in Mexico. I was a language major. I was trying to learn to speak Spanish pretty fluently down in Mexico. So this was a brand new experience when I moved down to this area. Still had long hair, and I was working with people would call them rednecks, and so that job on the drilling rig, they actually call people that work on a drilling rig roughnecks.
Roughnecks.
Roughnecks. That's the term for a job on a drilling rig. Roughnecks. But they were they knew. I mean, as long as you worked, they didn't care what you look like. You know, I learned to work on motors at that job. It was always you know, there was gas pumps that needed to be worked on. It was another dangerous job. You know, there's a lot of injuries. Most of the guys that I work with are missing toes, fingers. That was the funny thing about that job is that's when I cut my hair. I had when I noticed it, and there was always somebody on that crew that was drunk every night. It was another I had the evening shift. So out of four guys, one guy would a lot of times would be drunk, maybe a couple of them, and accidents happen. So I did have some nightmares about my hair getting caught in the cables. Because you're dealing with chains and cables, ducking under them. So, cut my hair.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a station break. When we return, we will continue with our Conversations in Southern Illinois series, talking with Mr. Clint Heisey. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Check us out on our website on sotrueradio.org. If you're on Facebook, you can look for us and like us on Facebook. And we're also on SoundCloud. Look for us there. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. By the way, on Twitter and Instagram, you could find our handle at SoTrueRadio. And today for our SoundCloud listeners, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in St. Louis, Missouri, and internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Belgium. We now turn our attention back to our Conversations in Southern Illinois series, today featuring longtime Southern Illinois resident Clint Heisey.
A lot of people may not realize who haven't done this kind of work is that in doing either the logging work or working on the oil rig, there's a way in which your body itself is on the line, isn't it? I mean, there's a risk involved in it, as you were saying. Guys were missing limbs. You had your foot crushed.
All
it's
these
just
jobs.
Dangerous work. So
all
your
these
body
jobs,
is really on the line.
You're trading.
To do this, you're trading in a way.
You're trading
your body for money. Trading your body for money.
You know, I have never been a coal miner. I've been in coal mines where I was working on machinery, and I didn't like being underground. Mm-hmm. So you have to put yourself in their position. They are directly selling their health to support their family.
Selling their health to support their family. That's quite a statement there. And so you cut your hair to avoid that, to avoid another type of accident.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us, before you dropped out of school and you had the job on the logging and the oil rig job, happened after you dropped out of school?
Yeah, that was right. Several years later after I moved down to Southern Illinois.
Right, yeah. But what about this period that you were traveling? How long were you traveling, and how did you survive when you were?
I would work.
I mean, how did you get an income?
I'd work for a while, save my money. Usually,
what kind of work?
Well, I would work as they call them roustabouts in the oil field. You know, laying pipe, digging ditches, digging trenches, cleaning tank batteries. That's the tanks that catch the oil, where the oil is held until it's picked up by a tanker.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be painted every so often. It was
a
good
was
job.
This?
We're close by in the 30, 40, 50 mile range from
okay.
where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
This was the Saline Basin was a big oil producer from the 30s and 40s on. It only a lot of the fields have played out by now, so it's not a big producer. There's still oil that comes out of this area. So that was these are the kind of jobs that an unskilled worker can do.
I got that, but you wanted to travel, and that's about 40, 50 miles.
No.
Where else did you travel?
Well,
in terms of
I would work on these jobs around here. I would,
uh-huh.
And then I would go to Mexico,
so you'd work on these jobs, make some money,
right?
Save the money, and then you would
take off
in the winter.
Usually in the winter, I took off in the winter.
In the winter,
yeah.
And you would live on what you
had saved.
Had saved,
right?
So you didn't have to find work then when you were in Mexico. You were also in Colombia.
Well, if I had the opportunity to stretch that little bankroll, we're not talking about a whole lot of money. You know, mm-hmm. $500, $600, maybe $1,000. I would work different places. In Florida, I worked for he was a commercial sculptor. Mm-hmm. He would do sculptures outside of businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So I helped him. He was working a lot in concrete, and the raised beds that you saw out here,
mm-hmm.
basically he would make big relief sculptures in the same manner that I made those. He would have forms, and then he'd pour the concrete in there and release them from the forms. That was a...
And these
maybe,
are raised beds where you're growing vegetables now, right?
Right.
Okay.
So, that's just an example.
Some of the skill that you learned working with this guy helped you in terms of creating.
Down the road.
Yeah.
All along the way, the skills that I learned, I'm using now.
Right. Did you have any jobs that were not in the U.S. that you did while you were in another country, or not really?
I taught English in Mexico. I had some jobs down there that helped me. I would trade room and board for English lessons. I was living in Oaxaca then, and I had an opportunity to teach in Mexico City, but it was just too dirty back then.
Pollution wise?
Yeah. It was hard to breathe for me. I was used to good, clean air, and that I didn't want to stay there very long. Let's see. I didn't ever do any. That was the only job I had in Mexico. When I was in California, I've told you about working for the...
Well, tell us about that, because you worked as a caregiver at some point.
That started in Mexico. Uh-huh. There was an American family that lived down there.
In Oaxaca?
In Oaxaca.
Mm-hmm.
He had been stricken with ALS. He had been a math professor at a university in California. Came down with ALS in his 40s.
Mm.
His wife was an archaeologist. So living was a lot less expensive in Mexico. They could afford to live off their savings and then what she made, hire Mexican help. So he had two boys.
Two young boys.
I went to school there when they were living there. They would come back to the States about once a year to get their financial done. So I started working for him when his help needed off. Learned how to care for him at that point, dress him, bathe him, take him to the bathroom, feed him. And
the kinds of jobs that one would describe a home care worker would do now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And he's a wonderful man. Had a brilliant mind. So that was just a temporary work, a day here, a day there, just to make a little money. I enjoyed that. But at some point I had run out of money and needed to come back to the States. I had waited a little bit too long. I had very little money left, so I was getting ready to hitchhike back, and it turned out he was coming back. They offered to let me ride with them, and I helped them, and they were bringing their Mexican helper. He had gotten papers so he could come into the States and stay with them.
Right.
So when we got to the border, something was wrong with his paperwork. They wouldn't let the helper in, and they put him on a bus to go back home. I guess they couldn't straighten it out, and offered me a job to go with them to California. And as I didn't have any other plans, it seemed like a good opportunity. I had never been to California. I needed the money. I needed to work. So I traveled back with them and got to enjoy the Carmel area. That's where they rented a house there. And I didn't realize what a ritzy place I was staying in until later on. But I appreciated the beauty, and all the time I had off, I was able to go down and just sit and watch the ocean. And that was amazing for me, you know, being from the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
But
what were the days like? Like what In terms of the work that you were doing, how many hours a day were you doing caregiving?
I was basically with him anytime he was up. You know, I would get him up in the morning, dress him. He could do a little bit of feeding of himself, but he wanted to do that as much as he could. His problem was he was getting worse. I thought the job was going to be just maybe a month or so, but he had gotten into a research program mm-hmm. at the university there, and they were just starting on the biofeedback studies at that time. That was still questionable science in a lot of people's minds. Yeah. They thought it was hokum. But they were doing some pretty advanced research, and he got in the program because he was losing circulation in his extremities. He was cold all the time. A lot of my job, one of the parts of my job was I gave him massage because he was his muscles were all of course they were stiff. He couldn't move his joints, and I would rub his hands and his feet to get the circulation going. So he was enrolled in this program, and they were teaching him how to use his brain to raise the temperature in his extremities. You know, by getting in a certain state, you can control that. So they would train him with the, you know, they had the electrodes on his head, so they could tell him what state he was in, and he would learn to change that. There, at the end of the program, he was raising him by a degree. That was a an amazing accomplishment to him.
Yeah.
And by that time, I was probably it wasn't a hard job, but it was difficult.
The hours were long. You were with him, or
right.
had to work pretty much when he was awake.
Exactly.
So about how many hours a day would you think that would be?
14 hours. I'm sure there were about 14
days.
Hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was that would you know, in that time, I'm not with him. I mean, I can sit. I guess I could watch TV. I could read. But then if he needed something, I had to be available.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't. The whole family was great. The wife was appreciative. She knew that I made her husband's life better. So she always. Mm-hmm. There were the kids. Of course, they had two good boys, and they didn't want to burden them with helping their dad overly. They had to, you know, because the wife wasn't physically capable of moving him.
So you did that part.
Yeah, I was in good shape. It wasn't a problem at all for me to lift him from the wheelchair to the bed or, you know, to a sitting chair. But eventually it was, I got a little taste of it. And that, I worked for him for about, 4 or 5 months. They stayed longer because of this program mm-hmm. than they had originally planned. And eventually, it just wears you down. You know, even yeah. it's not physically strenuous. It's the hours and the emotional toll of seeing somebody deteriorate.
The work of caregiving. So that required different skills than logging.
Yeah, I mean, well, that was
sludge.
Yeah, that was
sludge.
That was previous to those jobs here.
Okay,
that was while I was traveling.
Okay,
it was shortly after that. I had let's see, when I left there, I went to San Francisco for a couple of weeks. Traveled up to Washington for a visit there. And near Bremerton, Washington, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place. wild berries growing everywhere, and could swim in the ocean. It was quite an experience. But then I had then I came back here, had the great opportunity to buy this property. And that's when I started learning how to.
And your family was here? Your parents were here?
Yes, my dad and my mom were here, and my one of my sisters lived in this area. It was only thanks to my dad that I was able to get the loan on the on this property. You know, back then they wouldn't. You wouldn't loan somebody. It was 21, 22. Didn't have a steady job, so.
So your dad was a kind of a guarantor in a way.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
For the loan for the property.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That was land was cheap back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like now. You know, property sold for. $200 or $300 an acre.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and that most people probably would think at $2,000 or $3,000 an acre that would be cheap. People in the city, I'm sure, pay a whole lot more than that for a lot. So, but back in the '70s, land was inexpensive.
So, was it a land, and did it have a house on it that you could live on, or
it had
was it just the land?
It had an old farmhouse on here that hadn't been lived in for about 20 years. No electricity, no road, basically.
What about water?
It had a cistern fed off gutters and a pitcher pump in the kitchen. That was the pump. When I moved here, the pump wasn't functional, and the house was, while it was sturdy, it was pretty simple. Four rooms around a chimney. Sawmill lumber.
It was a wooden house.
Wooden house. You could, you know, you basically could see through the boards, the sawmill boards. You know, you see through. You could see outside. I mean, it wasn't modern by any chance. You know, but.
So how was it heating? I mean, so the insulation was limited, and
there was no
insulation. It gets cold here. There was no insulation.
There, it had cardboard and newspaper on the walls to kind of block the gaps. You know, a lot of the original homes in this area were built like that, just sawmill lumber. People, it's amazing how they lived out, you know, back then here. It was very, very simple. And hard life, like, you know, there's a cemetery that is part of this property originally for the family. The Baldwin family grew up here, and when you look at the tombstones, you can kind of get a historical idea of what the life was like, how long they'd lived here. So the house was probably 60 or 70 years old at that point. It had several generations raised there. From the tombstones, you can see maybe when a disease came through and several of the children died at around the same time. You know, by reading those tombstones, you can get an idea of the timelines of the life here. But nobody had lived there for 20 years when I moved, and so I had to rebuild the house, put in a water system, and that's when I became interested in solar power. I couldn't afford...
So putting in the water, so in rebuilding the house, I mean, did you have... were you able to take showers in the house? Was there...
No.
You had running... No, right, okay.
No, we had an outhouse.
You
I built
an outhouse.
Had to build an outhouse. I had to build an outhouse.
I took a shower. There was a creek running down one corner of the property. At that time, originally, that's how I bathed and hauled water from the creek for drinking.
Even in the winter?
Well, you got to remember, there I was still at that stage. I was still traveling.
Mm-hmm.
I would leave when it got cold. I would leave when it got cold. Yeah. So the progression was several years after that. I would work on the house and then leave when it got cold. I got the water system fixed and a very simple power system at that point because I couldn't afford to have power run back here.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team and today's audio engineer. I'd also like to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @SoTrueRadio. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.